we're just making sure that there are plenty of tugs available to handle them, and we've identified an anchorage area.
A massive disabled cargo ship makes its way slowly to Dutch Harbor. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 1st. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Shell tallies the expense of the Kullett grounding.
The $40 million I mentioned is the pure salvage cost. The $50 million is everything else, Coast Guard, our own vessels, etc.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You have the power to help others when you file online for your PFD. It's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. You can make a real difference and support causes that matter most to you, from feeding the hungry, supporting youth in education, or sustaining the arts. Learn more at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by ExxonMobil, North Rim Bank, and Doyon Limited.
At 1,000 feet, the Shinonoe is longer than three football fields, laid end-to-end, and right now the supersized Panama-flagged cargo ship is operating with reduced engine power in the Bering Sea. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, Unalaska is gearing up to offer the vessel safe harbor.
When it finally arrives in Unalaska next week, the Shinonoe will be one of the biggest vessels to ever stay in port here. It's 150 feet wide with a 60-foot draft when it's full of coal, soybeans, or iron. Right now, it's empty. It was traveling along the Great Circle shipping route to Prince William Sound early this week to pick up cargo when its turbocharger failed just west of Attu Island. Ed Page has been tracking the vessel for the nonprofit Marine Exchange of Alaska.
She has less power than she normally would, so she can't make good time or good speed. She's plodding along, if you will, at about 5 knots through the Aleutian or through the Bering Sea.
As of Friday afternoon, Page said the Shinonoe was about 600 miles northwest of Unalaska. He's been feeding this information to the Coast Guard. Lieutenant Jim Fothergill is with the Marine Safety Detachment in Unalaska. He says his office is monitoring the Shinonoe too. But beyond that, Fothergill says there's not much for the Coast Guard to do but wait.
We're just making sure that there are plenty of tugs available to handle them. And we've identified an anchorage area, and we're watching the weather to see when we're going to have a good window to bring them in.
The National Weather Service is forecasting 30-knot winds for the eastern Aleutians through Sunday. The weather is supposed to clear up on Monday, with the Shinonoe set to arrive in town Monday afternoon. Rick Enneman is a Marine pilot who's been coordinating the local response. He says there was never any risk of a grounding or a spill in the Aleutians, but the Shinonoe is traveling so slowly, at times just 1 knot, that it's hard to maintain its steering. That's going to make it tough to get the giant ship into Unalaska. Normally, a disabled cargo ship would need 2 tugs, but because of the Shinonoe's size, Enneman has been looking for a third to help out. He says another Marine casualty has tied up some of the best resources in the state.
Shell has everything wrapped up right now. They've got the AVIC, which would have been a great fit for this particular job. The Coast Guard's been looking. We've been racking our brains out.
They finally found the tug Ocean Ranger, which is heading up from Southeast Alaska to assist the local tugs. Those vessels will have their hands full with other shipping traffic around town. Fothergill with the Coast Guard says that shipping traffic is part of the reason why the Shinonoe won't tie up at Unalaska's new emergency mooring buoy, just installed this winter.
Because the emergency buoy is more if it is an actual emergency, and their ground tackle sufficient, and we're not really willing to tie up the emergency buoy with this bulker.
Once the Shinonoe gets to Unalaska, it'll anchor in Summers Bay, well outside of town, for a few days while its turbocharger is replaced. Vessels don't usually anchor in Summers Bay in winter, since it's partially exposed. But given the special circumstances, the Coast Guard's made an exception. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Shell's chief executives responded to questions about the January grounding of the Kullett drill rig during the company's annual results conference in London yesterday. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce listened in and has this story.
In his prepared presentation to shareholders, Shell's chief executive officer, Peter Voser, played down the company's many mishaps in Alaska last year.
Despite making some progress, we have run into problems in the last few months. Our rigs will need more work if they are going to be ready for the 2013 drilling season. One, the Noble Discoverer needs a series of upgrades, and the other, the Kullett, ran aground in a heavy storm on New Year's Eve and has been damaged.
Voser reiterated that the company considers the Cullent grounding a marine shipping incident, completely separate from its drilling operations in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. But he wouldn't elaborate on whether the grounding could impact drilling plans for this summer.
We need to wait for the investigations, which some external bodies are doing, but we also internally, assess the risks and the learnings, and then actually lay out our plans for the years to come.
Voser emphasized that the company is viewing the grounding as a learning opportunity.
I cannot say what the learning is at this stage, but let me also say, and I know this is always dangerous to say because it will generate the headlines, but I haven't seen in the world any business, not just the energy business, but all businesses, they have risks at the end of the day, and you need to manage those risks, and we do it as good as we can.
Following up on that statement, Tim Webb, the energy editor at The Times in London, asked Voser if Shell was moving the rig from Unalaska to Seattle in order to evade Alaska's oil and gas property tax.
Assuming you say that's true, I mean, because I think that came from Shell, would you say that's an example of maybe Shell not managing risks correctly or making a poor decision in terms of managing the risk of Alaska?
In response, Voser denied that the decision to move the rig had anything to do with taxes, saying that the $5 to $6 million they would have had to pay is nothing in the grand scheme of things.
There was a statement made by a Shell person, but in a completely different context, in a completely different meeting. That was then taken out of that context, and someone made a story out of it. Just to be very clear on this one.
The original story was written by Dutch Harbor fisherman reporter Jim Pollen. In it, he quoted an email from Shell spokesperson Curtis Smith that was sent before the grounding. Pollen says he stands by his reporting.
I don't think Shell would be backing away from that comment had it not gone aground. I think they would have been sending lobbyists to Juneau to try to repeal that tax. And I think that was, in my opinion, the motivation for making that comment that it influenced their decision to move it.
If the company was moving the rig for tax purposes, the cost of the incident has definitely exceeded what they would have saved. Chief Financial Officer Simon Henry said they anticipate spending at least $90 million on the incident in the first quarter of 2013.
The $40 million I mentioned is the pure salvage cost to the salvage operators. The $50 million is everything else, Coast Guard, our own vessels, etc.
Henry added that those figures don't include the cost of repairing the rig. He said that information won't be available until there are more details about the extent of the damage. The only information the Unified Command has released is that the rig is in sufficiently stable condition to remain anchored in Kaluta Bay on the south side of Kodiak Island. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The Alaska Republican Party's executive committee has blocked incoming party chair Russ Millett from taking his position. In a meeting last night, the committee voted to oust Millett, who was elected to the chairman's position at the party's annual state convention in April of last year. Millett says he's weighing his options to fight the decision.
What took place last night was illegal by party rules. They knew it was illegal, and they did it anyway because they have something that they don't want known, and I'm not quite sure what that is. They said that I didn't raise money for the party as finance chairman, so therefore they're removing me as chairman-elect, which I was last night, and they didn't want me to become chairman today.
The executive committee meeting was supposed to have been held today when Millett was due to start his term of office. Instead, Millett says the meeting was moved up to Thursday night to exclude him from voting. Millett can appeal the executive committee's action to the Republican State Central Committee, which can overthrow the decision. He has 10 days to file an appeal. Republican officials have named incoming vice chair Deborah Brown as the new party chair. Former chair Randy Riedrich explains.
By rule, she became, since we did not have a chair elect to fill the chairmanship, and she became the vice chair elect, became the vice chair, and since there was no chairman, she is now the chairman as of midnight last night.
Joe Miller, the party's 2010 candidate for Senate, says the establishment is trying to tamp down dissent.
The problem of having a corrupt GOP establishment that just simply will not accept Democratic outcomes, this is not the first time we've dealt with a situation like this. It's unfortunate, and I think it's going to hurt the party. The conservative cause is just going to be emboldened. I don't think it's going to deflate activism amongst conservatives in the state.
The leadership shakeup happens just as Miller is starting to reemerge. He's considering a 2014 Senate campaign against Mark Begich, and he says he met with the National Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee last week, but Miller says he's still a few weeks away from a decision. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering Tlingit Elder Clarence Jackson.
His Tlingit background, his Tlingit stories, and his Tlingit upbringing gave him a really good sense of oration.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Keegan Randall won the World Cup skate sprint near Sochi, Russia today on the same course that will serve as the Olympic venue next year. The Alaska Pacific University skier won all three heats. The U.S. ski team noted there was new fog and heavy snow throughout the race. It was Randall's third World Cup win for the season. She is currently in first place in the sprint standings and third place overall. Randall's teammate, Holly Brooks, placed 16th. Oral arguments were heard today in U.S. District Court in Anchorage for a lawsuit that challenges the decision made by the National Marine Fisheries Service to authorize the first of at least 3 years of seismic exploration in Cook Inlet. The lead plaintiff in the case, the native village of Chickaloon, is concerned that the air guns Apache Corporation plans to use to conduct the seismic tests will disturb the habitat of the remaining population of beluga whales. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
While on the hunt, beluga whales sound kind of like R2-D2 having a satellite phone conversation with itself. Those clicks and whistles are the sounds of the echolocation the whales use to hunt and communicate. Now imagine trying to have that same conversation while out on the hunt with this going on in the background. That's the sound that has the native village of Chickaloon worried. It's what an air gun sounds like being used to conduct seismic surveys underwater. Both of those clips are from the sound library of the Ocean Conservation Research Organization, and they represent the dynamic underwater soundscape that us land lovers don't get to experience. The plaintiff's suit seeks to rescind NIMF's decision to allow Apache Corporation to proceed with seismic testing using those air guns, which court documents say generate sound levels in excess of 200 decibels. Other studies have observed whales communicating much less than normal near testing sites. Rebecca Noblin is an attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity representing the Chickaloon Village.
Basically, what we're asking the federal government to do is go back to the drawing board on this one, take back its authorization to do the surveys, look at the science again, and we would say don't issue another authorization unless there's some way that they can mitigate all the impacts.
I called Apache spokesperson Lisa Parker for their take on the proceedings, but as Apache is an intervener in the case, she declined to comment. The plaintiff's suit contends that the decision violates portions of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Administrative Procedure Act, and would affect and possibly endanger populations of stellar sea lions, killer whales, harbor porpoises, harbor seals, fish, and Cook Inlet belugas. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Tlingit Elder and original Sea Alaska Native Corporation board member Clarence Jackson passed away yesterday at the age of 78. He's being remembered for his contributions to the Native land claims movement and for being an ambassador for Tlingit culture in both the business world and his personal life. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Clarence Jackson loved to sing hymns, as heard here at the memorial service for the Reverend Dr. Walter Soboloff in 2011.
Oh, my God, when I in awesome wonder.
comforting people in times of need was a role Jackson relished, says Sea Alaska Heritage Institute President Rosita Worrell.
He became like our ambassador from Sea Alaska, where he would attend all of the funerals, all the memorials. He was there to comfort clans and the family of those who had lost someone.
Jackson was born in Cake in 1934. He lived there most of his life, attending Sheldon Jackson High School in Sitka, before moving back to the village where he was a fisherman and operated a small store. Worrell says he was a great fisherman who loved boats.
We always say it is as if the spirits of the animals know him, and they give themselves to those kind of people who have those good spirits. So yes, he was a great fisherman.
In the 1960s, Jackson was involved in the Alaska Native Claims Movement as a delegate to the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indians. He served as Central Council President from 1972 through 1976. Also in 1972, Jackson signed the Articles of Incorporation for Sea Alaska, the regional native corporation for Southeast created under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. He was the only board member to serve continuously from the time Sea Alaska was founded. Current board chair Albert Kukesh first met Jackson when he joined the board in 1975. He says they quickly became friends.
We're both from villages right next to each other. He's from Cake and I'm from Angoon, and he knew my father and he knew Walter Sobloff, my uncle, and so I got immediately scooped up into his little circle.
Kukesh says Jackson was a champion of village life and traditional culture on the board, something he attributed to being raised by his Tlingit-speaking grandparents. Kukesh says his ability to speak both Tlingit and English fluently made Jackson a valuable asset to the board.
His Tlingit background, his Tlingit stories, and his Tlingit upbringing gave him a really good sense of oration. Very, very articulate. Not somebody who went to college, not somebody who went to law school, not somebody who went to graduate school, but somebody who went to the upper learnings of the Tlingit culture.
When the corporation established the nonprofit Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in 1980, Jackson became one of its trustees and served as chair of the Council of Traditional Scholars. Worrell says the council was instrumental in identifying the core cultural values that guide the institute to this day.
Clarence would remind us always, this is what makes us Native people. It's our cultural values.
Jackson spent much of the past 2 months in Seattle receiving cancer treatment. He recently returned to Alaska and died surrounded by friends and family on Thursday. A service will be held at the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall in Juneau on Saturday. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, hope. If you're in the habit of running East Anchorage trails in the winter in the dark, then you might have run by a compact, dark-haired doctor named Joni Hope, jogging slowly with her headphones on, singing. She is the state's only gynecologic oncologist, but she's also in a rock band that tours nationally to raise awareness for gynecological cancers. Their first Alaska concert is tomorrow. Anchorage Daily News columnist Julie O'Malley has the story.
Doctors' conferences aren't a typical venue for launching a rock band. But back in 2008 in Florida, at the annual gynecologic oncology meeting, a group of six doctors got together to play cover songs for their colleagues from around the country. Anchorage doctor Joni Hope was one of them. She says they rehearsed in the hotel hallway.
And then we got together and we did a show in front of 1,500 people in the big grand ballroom of the hotel.
Hope says the experience was fantastic, and it gave her the idea to form a band that would play original music. She always loved writing music, so she had a stockpile of songs to work with. At the time, Hope was finishing her training in Brooklyn. The drummer, Nimesh Nagarsheth, was also in New York and was on board immediately. For the rest of the band, though, it was a tougher sell.
So I sent an email out to the band, and I said, the band, we weren't even a band. I said, what do you think, original music? And they're like, no way. You're crazy. We live in different states, every single one of us. No way.
Hope and Nagarsheth were undeterred. He got them an audition with a small record label called Motima Music.
And he and I trekked up there to their studio, their office or whatever, and I auditioned for them. And I said, I have a band. They're all on board. You know, it's going to be great. We're going to do original music. Let me just show you a sampling of what I have, but there's more there. I mean, I just was like selling it. And I sang for them and I played for them, and they said, great, we love it. We'll do an album.
With a record deal in hand, the rest of the band members came around. They call themselves No Evidence of Disease, for the best four words a doctor can give a patient after cancer treatment. They recorded 2 CDs now and perform concerts regularly to raise awareness for gynecologic cancers. Hope says gynecologic cancers don't have a movement attached to them like breast cancer. She says there's a silence around the cancers because they are below the belt, and that silence can be dangerous because many of these cancers are also hard to detect. There's no routine screening for ovarian cancer, for example, and because of that, it is often caught in the late stages when it's much more deadly. Hope thinks the band can help save lives by raising awareness about symptoms women should watch for. Rehearsing with band members spread across the country can be tricky, though. They use Skype sometimes, and they practice on their own. Hope sings while she runs.
Starts with denial. There must be some mistake. Check the lab, check the name, double check the date. We bargain a while as the clouds settle on. A week, a month, a year, I can't predict how long.
No Evidence of Disease's music might be described as indie rock. Their audiences are mainly women, many of them cancer survivors who are in their 50s and 60s. At each concert, they do a tribute number where they invite survivors to come on stage with cardboard signs that have descriptions of their disease on one side and messages of hope on the other. I watched one of these tributes on video. It tore my heart out. Hope says she always cries too, but it also energizes her.
Maintaining hope in both myself and in my patients is critical. I mean, you have to believe in that, you know, that's what keeps you going. It's those success stories that keep you going. And the music is part of what balances that in all of our lives, all the band members' lives.
No Evidence of Disease will perform in Alaska for the first time tomorrow at Taproot in Anchorage. It's part of a weekend of events dedicated to raising awareness about gynecologic cancers. It's being organized by a volunteer group that Hope helped start called Let Every Woman Know Alaska. Hope says she wants to start a movement in Alaska, and the music is part of it. She wants to keep more women from dying of gynecologic cancers. In Anchorage, I'm Julia O'Malley.
Dreams and dreams, resurrected, length of travel, unexpected.
This story is part of a collaboration between the Anchorage Daily News and APRN. ADN photographer Mark Lester contributed to the piece. To find links to Julie O'Malley's print story and a beautiful audio postcard Mark Lester put together about Dr. Hope, go to our website at alaskapublic.org. Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're visiting the Prince William Sound community of Chenega.
Sandra Angayak from Chenega. We have roughly around 50 people here, no stores, only accessible by plane or by boat, have to fly in all groceries. Local business is the Chenega IRA Council, and we also have a health clinic. We have one school
with three teachers, probably about 20 kids. We get our mail through Ace Cargo, and we get mail Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. That's if they decide they want to come. Sometimes we get up to 2 weeks delay in mail. The original site of Chiniga Island had to be moved because we lost 23 people out of 89 people that were there in the tsunami. This particular site on Evans Island was chosen because it is less likely to receive a tsunami than it would have been over in the old village site, which is probably about 30 to 80 miles away from here. We have mountains all around us, spruce trees. We live on the water. My favorite time of the year is January because we see the humpback whales and the killer whales right out in the water. But we see sea life all year long.
Sandra Ann Gayek is a tribal administrator assistant in Chiniga. 300 villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Julie O'Malley, Mark Lester, and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce and Lauren Rosenthal in on Alaska, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Shaylin Cochran in Kenai. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The Kinnickarm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.